And welcome everyone out there who is joining us for this first episode of Best Nerd Studio, an extension of the annual UIC Summer Institute on Sustainability and Energy. My name is Thomas Allen, and I am the coordinator for the SIES program. And I want to first of all acknowledge that there is a lot of energy in this virtual room right now. This whole thing was dreamt up in 2014 by some of the folks on this program who wanted to continue the discussion that they had at the program and to share those discussions with the broader world. And finally, after several years, we're making it happen. And so excuse us if we are, you know, at times excessively enthusiastic. So today's Best Nerds Studio discussion is about the grid and is hosted by five 2014 SIES alumni, Kelsey, Ian, Kunal, and our inaugural Lord High moderator, Nat, as well as Maram, who is also a 2014 alum. And then, of course, there are other alumni and interested people from around the world who are watching at home either now or in the future. And we are honored to be in discussion with our annual guests, our first inaugural guests, George Crabtree and Lynn Trahey. Thank you all for being here. With that, my introduction is over, and I want to invite everyone in the room to briefly introduce themselves, their names, their line of work or interest, and a brief physical description, since this will be a podcast, and it will be super fun to see how everyone tries to describe themselves. So starting with Ian, let's take it away.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Hi, I'm Ian Monroe, class of 2014, like Thomas said. I work in sustainable finance, so basically I work with in the finance industry, trying to create a better world through our markets, which is super interesting and super fun. So bring it all around. I encompass engineering, business, everything in between, and kind of bring it all back together and help engage others on how to be better stewards for tomorrow. And I think I'll pass it on to Maram.
Hi, everybody. My name is Maram Falk, class of 2014 as well. I know Ian, Kunal, Lynn, and Nat pretty well, and unfortunately we haven't talked since then, but my profession is a senior energy efficiency engineer. I'm a supervisor now, supervising a crew that does energy conservation and distribution projects for the University of Minnesota. Go Gophers! My background is actually in energy distribution, which is very on topic for what we'll be talking about today. And I've worked in power plants, and I'm your boots on the ground person too. So a lot of application experience. My ambition is actually in policy work. I am now looking at how to bridge all the technology that we have with the policies that we need to have in place to all be successful. And I'm going to pass it along to Kunal.
Thanks, Maram. My name is Kunal Sahastrabuddhay. I am so excited to be doing this finally. Ian and I have been talking about this podcast on and off ever since the program in 2014. So we're part of the same 2014 cohort. I actually work in neurotech. My background is in physics and applied physics. I did my PhD working on solar cells. I work in neurotech now, but in my off time, spend a lot of time thinking about sustainability and very excited to do this to keep my interests and keep my commitment to this topic going. So very glad to be here and very glad to have all of you watching. Pass it on to Kelsey.
Hi, everybody. Sorry, I'm a few minutes late. I was out on a run because the weather here in Oregon is so nice. My name is Kelsey Slavor. I was in the cohort Kunal and Nat and Ian and Maram a number of years ago, so it's good to be back with everybody again. Right now, I'm currently living in Oregon. I'm in Eugene, and I work at a planning and landscape architecture firm here. I have a master's in planning, background in environmental science, and I've been working on parks and recreation master planning here in the state, but have also been doing a lot of just community advocacy and organizing around affordable housing and transportation and all kinds of good stuff. So I'm really excited for this conversation and really happy to be joining you all. And I'm not sure if anyone hasn't gone yet. Is there anyone I should be passing to? Matt, okay, go for it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really great to be here. I was in the 2014 cohort with some of these lovely folks, and it's really interesting of all of the various professional things and one-off events that I've participated in over the years. It's been really great how many of the members of SIES I've actually kept in touch with. I believe the last time I saw Ian in person was actually in London, where we met up for ramen, which was like really random because we both happened to be there at the same time. And then Kelsey, you came to visit Detroit one time several years ago and where I live now. So I am a city planner by trade, occasional journalist, self-employed consultant working in urban development. I do some work around sort of business process improvement and working with community engagement and development here in Detroit and beyond. So I have a, you know, lifelong interest in sustainability, but I'm really excited about the program today. So, yeah.
And I believe now we get to hear a little bit about you, George, and you, Lynn.
So I'll start. So I'm George Crabtree. Thomas and I launched SIZE, I don't know, 10 or 11 years ago at UIC. Really a wonderful program. So great to see all you guys from the 2014 alum and cohort and hear what you've been up to. It's terrific that you're out there in the world making a difference. So in addition to my position at UIC, I'm the director of the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research, whose acronym can be pronounced JCESR. That's led by Argonne. And Lynn is one of the colleagues in JCESR. You'll hear from her in a minute. We're really excited about the grid. We're really excited about getting decarbonized by 2050. We're extremely excited about the new administration, which is moving so fast and so, I would say, ambitiously on climate change. So I think I'll leave it at that. Looking forward to the discussion. Lynn.
All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Lynn Trahey. I work with George at Argonne National Lab, although I live in San Jose, California currently. I got into batteries through chemistry. So my PhD is in chemistry. But in undergrad, I did science, technology, and society as a minor, which is a lot like SIZE in some ways. And that just kind of kept pushing me into doing research that had an environmental impact. And then, of course, batteries was the way to go when I graduated. So here I am, and it's really been just fantastic. I do research integration for JCESR. So this is based on my obsession with people talking to each other so that the wheel is not constantly reinvented in science and engineering. So I could talk about that all day. I won't. We don't have that much time. But that's what I do, research integration, just making sure the left hand knows what the right hand is capable of and then leveraging that.
Excellent.
And was I crazy or were people supposed to physically describe themselves? I don't think anybody did that.
I saw. I realized that way too late. And I
I'm sure we're all wearing like disintegrating pajama bottoms. And
that's okay. We're all live. We're
I
not
have real
cast.
Pants on. What are you guys talking about? I came prepared.
Excellent. Well, good, Nat, since you're prepared. Why don't you lead us into the discussion of the grid, please?
Sure. So, you know, this is obviously an interest subject of interest to all of us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. If I go back to 2014, SIZE was in large part my introduction to a lot of this stuff. So I had been really involved in the sustainability scene in Chicago around buildings. And so, you know, buildings account for a huge percentage of total carbon in the economy, which is, you know, it's a vital concept. But I think it's really also, you know, valuable to think how we can move beyond things like saying, oh, you know, LEED certification will save us, and thinking instead about things like, how does the power grid work? Because this is, you know, this has become increasingly an issue in recent years as we faced unprecedented levels of disruption from whether it's from climate change or things that have been made worse by climate change, increasing severity of storms, hurricanes, et cetera. Or what's really interesting is this idea of you know, deterioration of infrastructure and how that has affected power transmission specifically. So in my house, for example, like we have flickering lights a lot. We have to reset the clocks a lot because we have a deteriorated local power grid. And this is a thing that is like a well understood issue. It's also a question of how are utilities supposed to make money if they have to replace legacy infrastructure that they don't really have a huge incentive to replace. So we have these increasing incidents of power outages and real struggles to maintain reliability for ratepayers. At the same time, I think, you know, like going back to SIZE again, I didn't really know what to expect. And what I really enjoyed about the program was the fact that it was basically a crash course in everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had no idea how a power grid worked. I sort of understood that there was power that got generated at a power plant and then transmitted somehow to my home, but I didn't really think about everything in between those steps. And so currently I'm wrapping up my MBA at American University in DC, the Kogod School of Business. And for my capstone project, I'm looking at this question of next generation infrastructure, and the grid is sort of a direct part of this. I'm focusing on transportation infrastructure specifically, but one of the really interesting things here is that there's this nexus between transportation and energy that we sometimes think about and we sometimes don't pay any attention to. And that's kind of what I'm trying to study. You know, this goes back to, you know, you can trace it back to the 18th century and the origin of how, like, coal mines, they developed steam engines to pump water out of coal mines so the coal mines could be more productive. And then the coal had to be moved, and they figured out a way to use the steam engines to move coal, you know, to population centers where it could be burned as a source of fuel. So this goes back, you know, hundreds of years. But we also have this issue in the modern day because we have, you know, the advent of mass marketable electric cars, battery storage for off-grid, whatever. And so, you know, I'm in Detroit right now, and we're certainly the center of the automotive universe. And it's really interesting to see, like, what changes are being made to as far as the business models of automakers going from saying we're going to sell, you know, X number of F-150s every year and that's going to be our profit. We're moving more toward this idea of saying like, what is mobility going to look like in the future? My interest in this from a research perspective is this question of what is the public sector role versus the private sector role. At SAIS, we were at a university, which is a nonprofit institution. We also had the amazing opportunity to visit Argonne National Lab and see, you know, these facilities where some of these scientific things were developed for the first time ever. And it was just sort of like this amazing experience. But a lot of this really evidenced the importance of collaboration across sectors to make sure that, like Lynn mentioned, the right hand knows what the other hand is capable of. I think that's something that we, you know, we see a lot in automotive, especially, you know, it's less that it's being duplicated than the fact that it's not being coordinated. And there's a question of how to coordinate that. There's a question of, you know, what is the public sector's role as far as regulating these issues? There's also a question of how to facilitate innovation without really sort of like putting a damper on the private sector's ability to innovate or move capital or, you know, produce widgets or what have you. So, you know, I could definitely talk about this all day, but, you know, suffice it to say, I think the biggest focus of what I'm interested in is sort of the focus of what we're all interested in, which is the question of how do we build a more sustainable and resilient infrastructure for all of us? And the reason why the grid makes this a good target is because it can start locally, but it can also be scaled up at a national level. And when I think about transportation, you know, the idea of like moving toward electrification of vehicles, that is very much part of the conversation on grid resilience because of how, you know, distributed generation works, which we'll get into, and the like. So, you know, battery storage, distributed generation, renewable energy, etc. So, yeah, I think we're going to talk to Kunal. Kunal is in sunny Texas, the Lone Star State. And I believe we're going to talk to Kunal about his experience in a recent event that you may have heard about involving some winter storms.
Yeah, thanks, Nat. Like Nat said, you know, the grid has, I guess I'm going to tell you about just sort of a personal story of what happened recently with the winter storms when the entire infrastructure failed catastrophically for millions of people. But that's obviously not the only way things fail. Nat's already talked about occasional blackouts, occasional power glitches. All of that, to me, talks to, whether it's a routine failure or a catastrophic failure, talks to need to build resilience. But if you live in Texas, what I'm going to tell you is going to sound awfully familiar and awfully recent. About a month ago, less than a month ago, we had a huge storm come down, move south through all of the states that routinely get cold weather and winter storms up north, Minnesota, Wisconsin, all the way down to Texas. The difference was that because a lot of the northern states routinely get this, they managed to weather the weather with really fairly minimal disruptions, you know, a few blackouts here, rolling blackouts and so on. But we were told that everything was going to be fine, prepare for maybe some rolling blackouts. And we thought, okay, it's going to get cold, we'll be huddled, but, you know, the power is going to stay on, it's going to be fine. So imagine my surprise when I wake up at about 4 a.m, the storm rolled in on Sunday night, and I wake up at about 4 a.m. on Monday, and it's feeling a lot colder than usual. And I said, okay, it's cold out, maybe it's just cold inside, tried to turn on the light and the power's out. So I looked up the Austin Energy website and looked up various utilities all around Texas to see what was going on. It turns out they'd already started rolling blackouts a couple of hours before that. And so I called the utility and said, hey, what's going on? I've been without power for 2 hours. And they're like, sit tight. It's just rolling blackouts. You'll have power again. You know, they're supposed to be 45 minutes. There might be a little bit of trouble. It's been a couple of hours. I said, call back later. And I said, okay, trust that they know what they're doing. Better go back to sleep. And
that's always the solution. About 8 o'clock in the morning,
ready to start work, and still no power, still no heat. And we're very, very lucky, I have to say, that the gas and the water kept flowing. So we could cook, we could manage the essentials, we had clean water. But that started
in your case, Kunal, because other people were not very as fortunate.
Yes, so that's what I'm saying. We were here, right here in this house, extremely fortunate. Mm-hmm. But that started, that blackout that went out, that was supposed to be the beginning of a 40-minute rolling blackout, was actually the beginning of a roughly 2.5-day period that we had no power. Again, in my case, I was lucky. After about 2 days, it came back on for a couple of hours, let us run the heater, get the house back up to temperature. Again, very lucky that my house never went below 50 degrees Fahrenheit. But I heard horror stories. It took a few days for me to hear horror stories because power had gone out, the cell service had gone out. I had no connection to the world, right? So all of these things we take for granted had just failed, despite assurances to the contrary that we were going to be fine. And that got me thinking about, you know, what does it mean for the grid to be resilient? Because as we move forward, this is going to be more and more frequent. Weather systems, you know, more extreme weather. Nat talked about stronger hurricanes. The hurricanes don't come up to Austin, but the winter storms, as they get stronger, certainly will come down here More frequently. I heard stories of people who are without power for over a week, people who are without water for over a week, which is, I have to say, after that ordeal, much, much worse, and definitely was eye-opening to go around Austin once we had power back, once the ice had melted and the snow had melted, to try to help people get potable water for a couple of days before all the utilities switched on. Because with cold weather comes burst pipes, with cold weather comes frozen everything.
So if I can sort of give some additional context as well here. So, and I'm not in Texas, but I'm sort of familiar with how this has gone down. But one of the things about how this event happened goes into this question of how the power grid actually works, which may be valuable to illustrate. And we could talk about it in detail with our other, you know, esteemed experts here. But, you know, with Texas specifically, obviously it's a warm weather state for the most part, and people are not used to freezing temperatures. And so, you know, this happened almost 10 years ago to the day.
About 10 years ago, yeah.
In 2011, yeah, mm-hmm. There was this, the Groundhog Day blizzard, which covered a lot of the United States, and it wasn't quite as severe in terms of temperatures, but it was cold. This led to ERCOT, the Electrical Reliability Council of Texas, which is the grid operator, to basically plan on these sort of like extreme weather events. This has also happened in other states, with Florida, for example, which has faced hurricanes. And in the early 2000s, Florida developed a plan for what it would be like to underground a lot of their electrical infrastructure to make it so power lines wouldn't blow over. They didn't do this. Power lines keep getting knocked out. So, you know, between Hurricanes Katrina and Harvey, which collectively had $100 billion plus in damages, and this storm, which actually eclipsed that one, we're looking at these things where these grid operators are having to plan for these events, then they're not actually implementing any improvements. So, Kunal, can you tell me about, like, what was your experience with, like, dealing with either your public utility or your local community? Like, but like, how did that work functionally as far as getting city services back together or utilities back on?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's kind of the extent of how it worked. I called them once and they answered because it was 4 a.m. and no one else was awake. I called them again at 8 in the morning and they said, our waiting lines are too long, call back later. So clearly I was not the only person having this problem. And by 8 in the morning, enough other people had woken up and noticed the problem and started calling in. And then, of course, from that point on, I lost cell service. So it's not even like I could really call them. I think the cell towers had lost power. So most of my experience was wait it out, grab as many blankets as I can, and wait it out and hope that the hot water lasts because I can drink hot water, and hope that the gas stays on so I can heat up water to drink and eat food. I mean, it was just, I've got to say, the most complete failure of a system that I have seen to date. And this with the context that I grew up in India that doesn't have sort of the same level of grid development. It certainly didn't when I was younger, where we did occasionally see blackouts where my grandparents lived, but they had a system of rolling blackouts and load shedding that actually happened on a weekly rotation. You would lose power for a day, but never for this long and never so completely that you could get in touch with anyone at the utility once people had noticed what was going on. And so, again, lucky that it came back after 2 days. We didn't have any burst pipes or anything, so I didn't have to call the water utility. They were swamped. I know people were without water for quite a while because basically every plumber in the state was busy fixing a pipe, and they went as quickly as they could fixing pipes. But people without water for weeks, people without, for a week, people without electricity for days. Some people, I think, also lost gas, but I'm not 100% certain of that.
It would also, it's also worth mentioning that there are a lot of households in Texas that don't have gas. So
I was going to say just that, because Texas designs with electric heating. That's the difference between the North Midwest, like we have in Minnesota, and the Dakotas. Our heating is gas. So when we get into these extreme weathers, we worry that our boilers can maintain the heat throughout the house. It's not whether or not the gas is going to make it here or whatnot.
Yeah. So that's a huge, you know, in terms of energy consumption, you know, if I'm recalling my numbers right, the Texas grid eclipsed their previous record for total demand. And so this is, you know, records in the context of a state that's growing in population are kind of, you know, it's not the greatest metric, but it's good for gauging how much the total system needs. But the previous record was set in the summer, and that's because power grids need a lot more energy to cool than it's much more power energy intensive to cool than to heat. The heating degree days measurement, you know, like, you know, how much heat you're going to have to plan on adding in your house is another thing. And that's the fact that cold weather climates, people rely on fossil fuels because they're relatively more efficient to heat than, you know, electrical resistance heating. Mm-hmm. But so, Kunal, I take it you had gas to heat, to cook on your stove. Is that, you know,
I had gas to cook, but I had gas to cook, but it's worth noting that at one point there was an advisory saying that we should limit our gas use as well, because I think much of the power for the state also comes from gas. And I think there were concerns about there not being enough gas for the power plants and for the people.
Well, and I think what I read also was that some households were turning their ovens on for heating because they were, it was just that bad. So that's not something anyone is advised to ever do, but I can't speak to what people would do in desperation when you have small children or anything in their household. So that's pretty scary.
Yeah, when I was, I think, 9 years old, it was the winter storm of 1992. And I was living in Alabama at the time, and it was very rural. And we lost power, we lost gas, we lost heat, water, everything. And luckily, my grandparents were with us. My grandfather just bought this brand new Cadillac, basically coming up to visit the family, showing my dad, hey, look, I got this new car. It's got heated seats. And at the time, my dad said, who needs heated seats? You don't need heated seats. And then nature's like, And that's what we had to keep warm. And there was other reports of people, you know, reversing the flow on their Teslas of powering their house in order to maintain some heat, or, you know, going to their cars to use, you know, the heated seats.
So, so that's like that. That's kind of an interesting, that's an interesting topic in and of itself, because there's this question of, you know, when we're thinking about grid resiliency, thinking about what is the technology that's going to really prevent this from happening. So with ERCOT, they, you know, the issue at hand was that they planned on a worst case scenario of, you know, it was like, I don't know, it was like 61 gigawatts, and they went up to like 68 gigawatts in demand. And so, you know, and this had still exceeded the previous summer usage and what have you. So immediately people try to point fingers. And so, you know, you have Greg Abbott, the governor, who goes on Tucker Carlson on Fox News, which I'm not really sure we can, you know, say that Tucker Carlson is necessarily a good source for credible, you know, professional discourse. But he comes out and says, like, well, this is the wind turbines that are to blame. And by percentage, the wind turbines lost a larger percentage of their total generating capacity. However, the total loss in power generation was, like, in terms of gigawatts, it was, you know, a bazillion gigawatts from gas. That's the technical measurement there, a bazillion. And that was lost because power plants that were not suited to operate in cold weather just shut down.
I think it's worth noting that I lived in Germany for 6 years, and Germany is by far one of the largest producers of wind power energy that I can think of the top of my head. I think for one day, 1 year, they had completely wind generated electricity for the entire country for one day. And it gets cold mainland Europe because of the Arctic flows and everything. Mm-hmm. We would get some pretty bad storms, but the wind turbines would still be turning. And that's because they had built in heaters and everything else to make sure that these still operate in the winter. In Texas, I believe, they said that, well, we don't need that. The state's going to be warm enough. It'll never get that cold here. So we'll forgo heating the wind turbines.
Well, and also not insulating pipes is something they've foregone to. I mean, like, Minnesota, everyone likes to joke, we're used to this. And for maybe a day, we in Minnesota were like, oh yeah, Texas can't handle this one day. We go through it for months at a time. But the same time, we've learned so many really expensive lessons over the years in having, like, some solid technology to heat buildings, power buildings. We've had those accidents and we've learned from them and put in, like, new types of insulation, recirculating pumps on mechanical equipment to keep it from freezing, because that stuff happens all the time too here. It's not, oh, Texas is just super, super messed up versus the rest of the country. It's just that we experience it more frequently. But in addition to that, it's what I've told people here, and I've told coworkers here, my experience with power plants is that the infrastructure and distribution lines are just as vulnerable in the rest of the country as they were in Texas. But because of the extremity and the unlikelihood of that extremity, it was experienced to that fault. And I wanted to go back to something you mentioned very early on about the grid operators. And I think there's a lot of credit to be given to the grid operators from, like, salvaging what they could in such an expedient manner and preventing this horrible technological failure from advancing for months at a time thereafter. So there was a lot of experience on the ground that helped key the power plants from total failure, I think. And I think a lot of people misconstrue thinking that what you do in a power plant at that moment is something that's felt instantaneously at the household in that moment. And these grid operators were working and solving these horrible problems. I would not want to be in their shoes. I've experienced demand response at a certain rate. I would never want to be in the position that they were in. But the fact that they were able to respond to something where they would not see the fruits of their labor until 4 or 5 hours later, I think there's a lot of credit to be given to people with that amount of experience to keep that infrastructure from total failure.
One of the other things that Seiss impressed upon me was the fact that this is not just when you flip a switch, in your house that's a magical that's not just some magical thing where electrons come out of your socket or whatever. It's like you said about demand response, like this has to be meticulously balanced, and this is happening 24 hours a day. I believe we have some content from Kelsey. I believe we have some questions from our email and live stream guests that
Kelsey's going to make all of us think.
Everyone's
favorite. Oh man, I hate thinking.
That's why we're here. Yeah, we came up with this idea for a segment that we'll keep pretty short, hopefully under 10 minutes. But this idea of, well, this is funny because I say size, some of you say size, so that's a conversation for another time. I actually pronounce all of this. But we had come up with an idea for a segment. We'll try it on for size, going off of my pronunciation. And we had developed some questions, or a question that we were going to prompt at the beginning or before the show. And so the first part was, in all likelihood, we are or our neighbors will experience a sustained blackout or energy insecurity event due to climate change in the coming years. And so with this in mind, what does preparedness look like for you? And we're kind of taking this question to then, if everyone wants to chime in, and then we can move into our discussion with our esteemed guests. But to start with, we had posed this question broadly among our alum, and we had one response that I'm going to read off from Gabe from the 2020 cohort. And Gabe had said, before the recent blackouts in Texas, I would have normally said being prepared for a blackout involved keeping some extra flashlight batteries around, a camping lantern accessible in the garage, and maybe a lighter near the stove. But now I feel that we should prepare for a far more extreme scenario that might also involve a concurrent intense weather event or natural disaster. And I totally agree with that. And I'm going to open it up if maybe like one or two people want to chime in with their idea, and I can kind of cap it off. But I wrote this question, and I think I'm specifically interested in it, not only from the grid situation in Texas, but conversation for another time, but the wildfires in Oregon this last fall were also extremely severe, and I lived through that, and it caused me to ask a lot of questions as well about what does just general preparedness look like. But I'll pass it off first. If Haram, would you like to take a shot?
Oh my God, I'm going to do the total Minnesota thing. Is we plan for winters, guys. We stock up on canned food in case we're snowed in. We make sure we have blankets. Something I've done this year is make sure I've had cat food because of our cats. So that's such a super nerd thing, I know, but like we always just make sure there's food around because you never know where your access to food will be. So making sure there's accessible food. And if you have medications that you take regularly, that's something you need to stock up on. My question to you, Kelsey, is what extent of an outage are we talking about? Are we talking about like a week? Are we talking about 2 weeks? Are we talking about zombie apocalypse? Because zombie apocalypse, I think I just need a machete. I've watched enough Walking Dead. I think I can handle myself. But in general, snowstorms and blizzards is making sure my boiler service then properly like maintained. So just those general things, I would say that's how I prepare. But if you can let me know if I'm planning for a much longer time, I can specify.
You know, I'll throw something in right here. It's interesting because, like, you know, we're thinking about like maybe a short-term power grid issue, but we're still going through a coronavirus issue right now, right? And if you remember back to the early days, like everybody was freaking out because they didn't have toilet paper or you know, like things like that. Funny, in my house, we happen to be hoarders, so we had like 6+ months worth of supplies, so we were good to go with all that. But it was, but I think, Marm, you bring up a really great point. Like, what are we thinking about, like a short term, like week or 2 week? How do you plan for something that goes longer?
I mean, something like this. I mean, this really goes. You do it in stages. I know in the military, we would do stuff like large projects like this in stages. We start with something small and slowly build up from there. With, you know, my wife and I were actually looking for solar panels for our house, you know, and a small battery solution, just so, you know, short bursts, but we can expand those battery packs for longer and longer battery storage. So if there is a long-term outage, you know, we'll be prepared for that. But this really just depends on how comfortable you are with certain things. Like, are you going to be okay without power for a while? Like, let's say a homeowner, you may at some point have a deep freeze in your freezer. It's going to be filled with
right
frozen vegetables and whatever right. else. And that's perishable food. So it's like things, mm-hmm. what level of risk do you want to take on with this? It's really kind of tough.
And the same with your battery comment, because I think people misconstrue that you can keep batteries for a very long time without really checking the charge and whatnot. So mm-hmm. you don't want to be in that bad position, you know, having batteries stored for 4 years and then they don't work on you when you need them.
Exactly. It is, with the battery research that we saw that was happening at Argonne, I mean, that really opened my eyes to a lot of, because my biggest hold up for solar cells for the longest time is like, well, it's great during the day, but how can we reutilize that at night? You know, when, let's face it, you're going to be close to zero, output from those cells. In some houses, they generated excess that, you know, would get fed back into the grid. But let's say you want to hold on to that extra charge that you generate throughout the day.
I want to add one more point, which I think might be useful for the next discussion. I actually have solar panels on my roof. In the last storm, they were A, covered with snow, and B, off, because they're not supposed to run when the grid isn't running. So they were doubly useless.
Did you just say they're not supposed to run when the grid isn't running?
Yeah, they're supposed to feed energy back, and therefore they shut them off for safety when there's nothing flowing in.
However, I would note that this is, solar power is actually one of the few sources in Texas that did actually retain most of its generating capacity through the storm.
It was a very sunny storm. I mean, as long as they were able to clean off the snow, there was sun all day.
But in some markets, isn't it illegal to store, to store your own energy? I mean, I'm not sure in every place you're even allowed to.
There are some areas where it is actually against the law to hoard energy. It's whatever you generate is supposed to get fed back into the grid. So you really have to check on your local laws, because in Pittsburgh, in some areas, it can be from borough to borough mm-hmm. in the same county. So one could have good, you can keep what you generate, like a rainwater barrel, but you move one town over, it's illegal.
I would also add, just like from my experience in Oregon and just my professional space and planning and public policy, I also think, to me, like, preparedness is also a lot more broad in many ways too, right? Where to me, like, preparedness is socialized medicine, preparedness is affordable housing, preparedness is all of the things that enable us to have more secure social infrastructure before things even like this happen. And like, just listening to Kunal's experience, knowing my experience in Oregon, and just how when so many people couldn't be outside because the air quality was so bad, and we were already dealing with an unhoused population to begin with, and then compound coronavirus, air quality, all of these other things, I think about it like, as much as preparedness is an individual, can certainly be an individual exercise, I've also just been asking myself a lot of questions about how, in what ways would our society have to change to have more people achieve stability, essentially, at the point that we're at now, before we even start compounding these disruptions and disasters kind of on top of that. So maybe we bookmark that. That's a conversation for a future episode. But I want to pass it off to Nat and get our experts in the conversation and tell us a little bit more about what.
I think we'd like to generally get some input from George and Lynn about what you guys are working on. And we want to know, like, what is exciting to you. So I don't know if, George, you want to start. Just sort of tell us about what you got going on these days.
Great. Thanks, Nat. And everyone, I'm really enjoying the conversation. And it's great to hear that you guys are concerned about the social aspects, not just the technological ones. And actually, this is a point that I wanted to make earlier. I was reading in the newspaper that some few people in Texas have Teslas that have power outlets on them, and they were able to power their homes from their car for a few hours, and all their neighbors came over to charge all their devices and to warm up. And it strikes me that this is one way to get prepared for the next emergency that is coming because of, electric vehicles and sustainability, and we've got to decarbonize. I think that's the driving force for EVs nowadays. And here's this dual use. Since you can charge your EV from the grid, it means in reverse, you can use your EV as a power source in an emergency. So that's an example on kind of the household level. But you could also imagine on the community level. So a neighborhood could get together and say, let's buy a battery. Let's have a little microgrid that's just for our neighborhood. And we do it by, consensus. And suddenly there's a lot more flexibility in the system. You would hope, in the best of all possible worlds, that your government, your local government or your state government would take care of it. And I think, thinking of Texas, I don't want to be critical of Texas here, but a few decades ago, they did disconnect themselves from the rest of the country's grid which they did quite intentionally. And here's a case where it might have been nice to be able to get a little power from some of the neighboring states. A lot of ways to think about this.
Can I ask you, when you mentioned the idea of having a power option for your house, do you have any ideas on like what that might look like as far as scale? Like you know, I'm thinking about it from the standpoint of these little power bricks that we can get at the gas station to charge our phones. I mean, is one or 10 of those enough, or does this need to be a Tesla Powerwall, or does this need to be some sort of industrial solution? What's your take on that?
For a house, it needs to be something like a Powerwall. And I think the Powerwall was exactly designed for basically a homeowner, that unit. And it's expensive. It's cheaper, of course, to buy a diesel generator than it is to buy a Powerwall. But the diesel generator, of course, produces CO2. It has some other issues as well. But if you're looking only at money, that's what you would do. The prices are coming down for batteries. They've fallen in 10 years by almost 90%, and they're still falling. We can get to the point where maybe that is at least competitive with the diesel generator. But that would be the responsible thing to do, I think.
So tell us about what you're specifically working on yourself these days.
We have a number of things going in J. Caesar, especially having to do with the power grid. One of the things that we are concerned about is specifically long duration discharge storage. So you may know this, a lithium ion battery can discharge for about 4 or 6 hours and that's it. It'll be fully discharged. That's if it's discharging at full power, but that's nowhere near enough to cover the grid's issues. So the intraday ups and downs variability because clouds pass over, when you have wind gusts, lithium ion battery is perfect for that. Several days in a row, it can't handle. So we started looking at this problem in 2015, actually, how to have a battery that can discharge for 3 or 4 days in a row. And this is something that lithium ion simply can't do.
I'm remembering my SICE time. And, you know, before that, I had thought, well, batteries are either Duracell or, you know, like maybe I distinguish between lithium ion and alkaline, which are the ones that you buy in the big packs like Duracell or Energizer. I remembered growing up, we had a cordless phone that had like a nickel cadmium, you know, battery or what have you. So this technology, it's evolved over time, but a lot of these technologies were really developed in the 19th century. Scientists figured if you stick a couple things together, it'll create an electric current. How do we scale that? You know, at SICE specifically, I remember covered like zinc bromine batteries and these sort of other weird like flow batteries. You have some that are solid, some that are electric, liquid, you know, like is lithium ion the champion? Has it won out as you know, VHS over Betamax, or do you think we're going to see some competitors busting onto the scene in the coming years?
Yeah, great question. I think lithium ion is here to stay for sure. And it can handle transportation. It can power your car. You might like it to charge a little faster. You might like it to last a little longer. You might like it to be a little safer. All those things would be better, but it can handle the market, and manufacturers have made that commitment. But there's some things that it cannot handle, and this long duration problem is one of them. So we're developing a flow battery. It's a liquid battery, very different from lithium ion. And recently we spun out a startup company in 2017. It's called Form Energy. They just signed a contract last year with Minnesota's second largest utility. It's called Great River Energy. For a battery, they'll deliver it in 2023 that can discharge for 150 hours. That's about 6 days in a row. And that is, I would say, revolutionary in terms of a battery being able to do that. So it's out there, will be out there. We'll see how it works. This would have been pretty handy in the Texas freeze.
Yeah. Hey, Lynn, I have a question for you. So when I listen to George talk about all these like really interesting things, right? Like there are so many different types of batteries, so many different types of experiments and all this research going on. And your job, as I understand it, right, is like, how do we make sure everybody's talking to each other and they know what's going on? So that way either people aren't duplicating things or that people can kind of pick up ideas. How do you corral all these cats in the same room and make sure that they know what's going on and how
really painfully?
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So even here today, you know, someone mentioned that we're the experts, and I'm thinking to myself, I am not at all an expert on how the grid works. I'm a chemist. There's no chemist who's an expert on how, you know, the grid is actually functioning. So that's what I try to really do, is make sure that I talk to the people who are operating the grid. And this happens in, you know, creating workshops and going to conferences. And with COVID, it's all very different right now. So I'll give you one example. we want to like engage the community as we normally would in pre-COVID times about scientific research topics and draw in all the different perspectives on a particular problem and talk about it in a room. Well, now we're doing that in like 2-hour mini workshops over the course of a year to keep rapport going and keep people talking to each other. So I'm a fan of just increasing the collisions of people together so that we can ask these questions. And then I always nominate myself to ask the seemingly dumb questions because I believe that most of us are not on the same playing field as we begin a conversation. So I want everyone to know the jargon. I want everyone to get all of the easy questions out of the way so that we know that we're speaking to each other and that they're actually able to listen.
Do you, how does that play out as far as Sice and Lynn, you and George are both in the nonprofit, you know, research space? Yeah. How does that play out as far as coordinating across private industry, which is also spending a lot of time and effort and money researching this stuff?
Well, I don't know. Like in JCSER, we have scientists and engineers who initially relied a lot on techno-economic modeling to help us narrow down what to put our very precious energy and money into. So techno-economic modeling is informed by what performance do you need and what costs are required to make a technology matter. So those experts, those engineers would be talking to the systems operators for different applications to get that information. I think of Kevin Gallagher doing that for us earlier on in JCSER quite a bit, just talking to industry as much as possible to get simple things like what parameter for current density do you need for this here, or what price makes this possible and what price makes this totally impossible for you to implement.
I think what Lynn is talking about is so important. People forget that us in application are working with things that were decided for us 10, 20 years ago. So getting those people in the room and to properly plan for things that would be happening probably past our lifetime is the biggest hurdle. I mean, George brought up a valuable point about batteries, right? That this is necessary. It's not something of should it happen, it needs to happen if we are going to progress in our society as it is with technology. But the other part of that is what's bringing the sources of energy to everyone's homes? You know, the distribution lines, those are archaic aging systems. And no matter if you implement renewables and support it with batteries, something has to happen there. You have to upgrade lines. You have to reroute them for things like microgrid to work, because that's how microgrid works, right? Is that there's a separate route for power that comes in versus just a single source route. And if that line gets damaged or there are issues, there's a backup because it comes in from the other direction too. So I think that we have to talk about how not decentralized. I'm not a huge fan of decentralization of power, but I feel like we have to talk about how we build up community energy in supporting that centralized plant system. So that way we do have that reliability, like plugging in your Tesla to support that. So I want to know what other people think about what the future is for community energy and reliability.
Well, I hope you're looking to microgrids in places that have very expensive energy needs, like remote islands or places in Alaska. You know, I'm thinking of the Philippines, even Hawaii. There's a lot of models out there for people who have had to take risks and adopt energy storage technologies and see what they could do because they want lower costs than diesel. They want cleaner air and they need the reliability. So there's a lot that we can learn from how really in need, isolated places are getting their energy and bring that into some place that's not isolated, but just wants to be greener and more reliable.
I attended a webinar a couple of years ago on this issue, looking at remote, predominantly indigenous communities in Canada and I think Alaska. And it was looking at how, I mean, I had no idea about this at the time until I attended this thing, but it was basically about how, you know, because the supply chains are for oil are so well developed, it's basically like a given that you just rely on diesel fuel all year round.
Which is flown in.
It's flown in, which is crazy to think about how much energy that, you know, alone takes. And so they were piloting this program to basically build like turbines that would power a thing because they'd sit on the floor of an ocean, not an ocean, the river, which doesn't freeze at the bottom. You know, even when it's like very cold, it doesn't freeze. So it can power, you know, the sort of like low speed turbine. And these are the kinds of things that's like, it's not an insurmountable hurdle to do this. It's just like, it involves challenging a very well-established dominant paradigm.
And I think too, when we're talking about like the microgrid component, thinking about it too, like in kind of what Lynn was saying, it's not even necessarily about remote places as much as it's about, especially like city, just energy equity. And like, even the example of the Tesla that George was sharing, you know, we're potentially trending down this road out where people who have the resources and finances then have the facilities and the capabilities and the resources to get themselves through like the increased crises, right? And so I think like the microgrids also to me are the first step towards energy equity and like kind of the self-sovereignty of energy, especially in under-resourced communities, you know, throughout the United States, even in like very populous areas.
No, you're right there for energy equity. We had a power outage just summer or two ago. And where I'm at in Pittsburgh is on the eastern end. I wouldn't say it's a bad neighborhood, but it's like a rough area that we're kind of borderline to. The power first went out here and then I just tracked it and it never went further on to like the nicer neighborhoods. So I think like, you know, energy equity in and of itself like is very much important. And it's going to be a very much social issue in the coming, I would like to say years, but probably, you know, you're going to see a lot sooner than you think it will.
If I can put on my Mr. Market hat for a minute, I can tell you about Mr. Market and how the value proposition for creating these decentralized systems or more resilient local systems for generation, there's an enormous value proposition because with fossil fuels, your money is literally going up in smoke. And so that's one of the things that people often forget, but it's not just that it's going up in smoke, it's going somewhere else and then it's going up in smoke. So I think that, you know, having systems for local generation, like Ian mentioned, you know, this issue with I mean, we have this in Detroit where you have these legacy systems that are, you know, they're sometimes half a century old and they haven't been replaced or repaired since that time. And that's, you know, that's a huge issue and it disproportionately affects Black and Brown communities that have already high rates of, you know, what they call energy poverty, which is like spending a high percentage of your household income on utility bills. George, do you have any thoughts on the microgrid, you know, distributed generation subject?
That's a great question. I'd love to hear the discussion about equity as well. I noticed in the recent case in Texas, they relied, it was part of the system, relied on surge pricing to decide who gets the power. That is one of the most inequitable ways of doing it. And to me, that is that really needs to be looked at. And I'm shocked in the aftermath that people are pointing back to that and saying, hey, you got to read the fine print. It was in your contract. It's your fault. And this is just the wrong approach completely. And I think the again, the present administration after the election is really stressing environmental justice. You can think of that as energy justice. We do need to look at that. I mean, the question of, well, okay, we're going to have a rolling blackout. Who gets blacked out first? Somebody has to make that decision. And it's quite often not made in, let's say, an equitable manner. So great point.
On the issue of blackouts specifically, one of the things that really surprised me when I was learning about this is that they actually don't even count this as a question of grid reliability. They say, like, if the grid is blacked out as a matter of voluntary operations from the operator, it's not really considered an outage. So it's not really considered, it's not really factored into the question of reliability.
Yep, that's
and,
right.
And that means that, you know, the operator can, what is effectively an arbitrary decision, they can just say, we're going to shut off power to people. And if you don't have a battery backup system, which, you know, 99% of people don't or whatever, you're out of luck.
Didn't Enron do this in the mid to late 90s?
They did. Yes, they definitely did. It was a little bit different because it was more like, so Enron essentially built the markets for modern energy the way the stock market built, you know, derivatives markets. And so the idea was that Enron said, like, well, we can use this to more effectively exchange electricity across state lines or what have you, across markets and grids. But what ended up happening is the same exact issue where it's like, it actually just ended up becoming a way to make a ton of money. And, you know, the second there was any disruption to the stability of generation or demand, the whole thing literally or metaphorically blows up.
It's part of the industry to do scheduled shutdowns and whatnot, what you would see as blackouts from the end of the demand side. I mean, that's how you operate to keep things functional. It's called preventative maintenance. And actually, when you do get these scheduled downtimes, I think that's a good thing. Like, that means, you know, the industry is trying to keep up with the maintenance so that way you don't get those unexplained or unplanned for outages. So planned outages over unplanned any day. But the idea of having planned or unplanned outages more frequently in areas that are economically different from other areas. I mean, it's really sad to say, but that does happen. It happens all over the world. It happens in developing nations as well. So, and just to Kelsey's point, my whole perspective has been that equity is kind of the underlying driver to address climate change, regardless of what side of equity we're talking about, whether it's housing, energy, education, or whatnot, gender equity, they're all interplayed with what this is. So the grid is just one example of that.
So realizing that we're running out of time here, I'm wondering if we can have anyone weigh in on this question of, I don't want to be too much of a downer here, but what's the next Texas? What's that going to look like? We have reliability issues across the infrastructure, and that plays out in different ways in different areas. You know, in Michigan here, we had a couple of catastrophic dam failures this year from excessive rainfall mixed with, a lack of maintenance. I mentioned earlier the issue of Florida with the undergrounding of utilities that never happened. In the Gulf Coast, that's a huge issue. Petrochemical industry around the Gulf Coast is obviously susceptible to all of this, you know, extreme weather event risk. So, I mean, like California wildfires, you know, you pick your poison, right? So, like, what George or Lynn, what do you think are sort of our near term? What's the next thing that's waiting to fall apart, and how are we gonna, you know, what should we be thinking about?
Well, I'll give you one example, and Lynn may have some more, but hurricanes. So, this is 2020 was a banner year for hurricanes. And we had almost had two hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico at the same time. That's the first time that came near happening. Turned out one of them was only a tropical storm. So technically we didn't get two at once. But they ran out of names. They had to go to the Greek alphabet in order to name all the hurricanes.
That's right.
This is coming. And it affects, you look at where this is, it's certainly the Gulf Coast, the southern, you know, Alabama and around there. But also the southeastern states, and even as far up as New York, hurricanes can get up that far. And it threatens an awful lot of population centers. So my sense is, let's expect something there. And I think it's important to remember the past is no guide to the future. So we have historical, you know, what's a 100-year storm? Well, now we're getting 100-year storms every 25 years. We really have to rely on climate modeling, not statistics from the past, to plan for the next disaster.
I see just a bunch of like extreme weather events continuing like over and over again. I'm thinking about like how that's going to keep crashing infrastructure. We're going to see infrastructure, like you've all mentioned, just keep crashing all over the country and all over the globe. Think about Jackson, Mississippi. Do they have potable water yet in Jackson, Mississippi? So there's just so much we need to do. And I want everyone to think about how the electric grid must be completely unfathomable to the average citizen paying for energy, right? So I want everyone to understand how like the people that you elect politically have power over the science and engineering that connects back to your life. So the political, scientific, and engineering and personal connection I want voters and citizens to really think about. And as for threats, of course, they're going to be all extreme weather, but I'm also concerned with something of just cyber threats that will
shut
down.
That's what I was thinking, actually. Yeah. Yep, I totally agree with you, Lynn. I was going to say that we'll get an example of some statewide internet outage sometime soon. And that's the scary thought, because when you think about everything wrapped into internet serviceability, and that includes the grid too. So that's a little scary to think about.
It's sometimes not even the people you expect. So it's very easy to say, oh, this is the person for governor, or this is the person for attorney general. But it turns out in Texas, the railroad commissioner has a lot of say over oil transport. So like, it's very easy to just look in the wrong place. And unfortunately, so much of this is keep your eyes more open than the last time.
Hearing the size graduates talk about it makes a difference who you vote for. This is one of the reasons Thomas and I started SIZE. We said we need to educate people to understand how to vote and fold in the infrastructure, the future, the climate change. Of course, 10 years ago, climate change was not quite the same issue that it is now. But I'm so glad to see you guys talking about it, and also talking about others should do the same thing.
I believe Ian has some content for us as well.
So a little bit more behind me. I'm a bit of a trivia guy. I have a lot of knowledge in my head. I've had a litany of jobs throughout my life, so I have vast amounts of knowledge. My current coworkers are just astounded every time I say something. They're like, "Dear God, how do you know this?" And I'm like, "I can't tell you." So a few years ago, I was doing some research with one of my professors at university about grids and like the cost of how much does it cost on average per year for let's call it a normalized year. Like how much does it cost? How much do these storms cost the United States per year? Does anyone want to hazard?
Storms, you said? Like
from storms.
Like the damage control and whatnot?
Yeah, just from storms alone, how much do you think it costs the US average per year?
There's like a definitive answer to that?
There is.
This is the cost to energy? Does it cost to the grid or just the cost overall?
The damage incurred directly and indirectly.
Tens of billions of dollars.
I was going to say like 1 billion.
Oh, I bet it's way more than that.
This is in a year?
1 year.
That's what I was thinking.
Yes. I mean, I'm just thinking like the COVID relief bills, like they're talking like trillion something, right?
Yeah,
like,
they're talking 1.9 trillion for that. So
I would not be surprised.
So average per year costs, indirectly and indirectly. So this is lost wages, infrastructure costs of repairing the grid and everything else. On average, up until I think 2017, the stat was $33 billion.
Oh, so that was close.
That was close. NOAA has a really good stat repository of like cost of storms. And I'm like, how much did we spend 2020 on, like, how much did it total storms damage cost? This is including insurance, damage to grid, personal, mm-hmm. and everything else. It was $76.88 billion.
I believe it.
I do too.
I mean, if you remember the Puerto Rico costs, like, you could extrapolate just from that.
And think about the, okay, so George brought up bigger storms, so did Lynn. We're going to start seeing more of these 100-year storms more and more often. We're going to see more and more exponential costs. Like, costs are just going to exponentially rise in the coming years just because of it took Pittsburgh 30 years to replace a bridge that was literally, we built a bridge underneath it so it would not cause, you know, traffic accidents. So, you know, infrastructure-wise, you know, the U.S., you know, we have a big problem with repairing infrastructure.
Yeah, we do. It's...
And John Oliver did a great piece on it on Last Week Tonight several years ago. I still recommend people to watch it, even though a lot of the stuff has been, you know, fixed. But everyone around us, I mean, there's a famous line from a Calvin and Hobbes comic after their house got robbed. Mom's like, I can't believe this happened to us. I always thought it would happen to someone else. And the dad chimed in and said, well, we're all someone else to someone else. Mm-hmm. We're so caught up in us. I mean, in the United States, we're all caught up in us. And the problem is, you know, we're starting to see this with more and more generations. Like, well, it's not just me. It's everyone else around me. It's in my social bubble.
Ian, would you say it's hashtag not me, us?
I'm not going to answer that question.
That was so unexpected. I love it.
That was.
No, Ian, right. I think you're so right. I think at the engineering level, it's super frustrating that we're basically given duct tape to make sure we can keep carrying this boulder across that messed up bridge.
As someone that used to work on aircraft in the military, I can tell you that they in high pressure situations, that plane's got to fly. That mission's got to go. Oh. It's going to get done one way or another.
Yep.
And you just... fingers crossed that it works. And I have discussions with this everyone around me all the time. And in what George said too, it's like we're all talking about voting. And this all goes back to that as well. Mm-hmm. You're seeing a lot of people that want to reduce corporate tax, you know, tax on above certain amounts of income. And if we look back to the 60s, like I don't want to call it the golden age of science, but we had tax rates that were, you know, were a bit more fair and equitable across the entire board. Mm-hmm. I mean, we went to the moon on a really astounding budget that we were able just to throw money at.
Because there was political will.
Exactly. And now it's all coming back to like, well, let's throw our taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes. Well, just everyone think about this. When you lower your taxes, that money is going to be pulled out of something somewhere.
Political will specifically leads to this question of what we can do to get involved with next steps for the future episodes of this show.
I think Lynn had a very like valid point, and her entire profession is the driver for this future. Is this connection of the technology versus the policymakers versus the community and the rest of the industry? I mean, there's an ethics issue to this too, right? Because the engineers, like, we make it work because we have to make it work. People rely on us. Part of it is a question of, should we keep making it work like this? Shouldn't we just let it fail so that way the investment does go to something worthwhile? So I want to hear everybody else's opinion, because everybody else here are valuable scientists. It's just that from the engineering perspective, we are balancing our ethics with our job security, with the commitment we're making to the rest of the community as well.
I'm hoping we can hold our political leaders accountable if they think Infrastructure Week is a funny joke, you know, in Washington, D.C., because infrastructure is not a funny joke. It's jobs, and it's so important. So I just want us to be on board with people who push that way, and maybe ourselves get into politics and do that ourselves. We need more scientists and engineers, you know, running state capitals. Governors of states, you now see with COVID the power of a governorship, right? I mean, we all knew this before, but now you can really, really see the power that a state has. So let's get scientists and engineers with some know-how in those spots.
that's a lot of what I've been thinking about. And I am a person here who does not practice in science anymore. And I feel like directly, I should say, yeah, I feel like that was a lot of what pushed me into planning, because I was like, I want to go into social policy. I want to take what I understand from engineering and science and all the stuff I did in undergrad and kind of move that more into the political sphere, because it is kind of like they need to go hand in hand. So I just really appreciate that commentary. And I hope that's something we can keep moving forward in all of our discussions as we continue doing episodes.
Thomas, do we have a subject for our next episode?
No, I think we probably need to talk about that this week. But that's it definitely will be coming up. The plan is to do this every month. So we'll probably try to release that here in the next couple weeks and then try to get something a little more regular going on after that.
Well, I'm excited.
Yeah. So I guess that's my cue, actually. So because our time is over, I really want to thank George and Lynn for joining us on today's show. All of our hosts for driving the program and developing some of the content. All of our friends out there, alumni and visitors alike, for joining us. Best Nerd Studio will be back, as I said, sometime in April, probably early April, with another show. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, to follow us on Facebook, or sign up on the Size newsletter on uicsize.com for updates and to join us for the next show. And until then, this is Best Nerds signing off.